lot of companies struggle on caring. So you had said, this is my
title
cynical.
Of the show. That's the title of the show right there. Companies struggle with caring.
Great. I'm so happy to be here. So,
yeah, I was kind of hesitant. So, okay, so you
let's talk about it. Let's do it.
Well, you said they care about, and yes, I remember, and they do.
Hey, this is William Tincup, Ryan Leary. You are listening and watching The Practitioner's Corner. Hey, Ryan, how are you doing? It's all white.
I'm nice. Giving you the spirit fingers.
As long as it's not the super finger. Great. Tara, how are you doing today?
I'm awesome. How are you guys today?
You Amazing. Are awesome. It's a good day. It's bright outside. All is well. Would you do us a favor and introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, sure. So for those of you listening, my name is Tara Fournier. I am a chief people officer, and I'm super excited to be here. I've worked with Will for a long time, so it's good to finally be invited.
100%. Chief people officer versus CHRO. Are they synonyms?
I think it's a tomato tomato in some regards, yeah. Right? I mean, people, HR, people in culture, talent, it all really is the same thing. We're responsible for keeping people safe and keeping the company safe at the same time. So I think it's preference.
Pretty much. Because, you know, there was a period where we went through human capital and everyone kind of like, okay, what the hell, what is human capital, this, that, and the other. And then out of the Bay Area, I noticed probably a decade or so that there was a lot of people ops, people that maybe didn't have HR experience that kind of came over and did people operations or people ops. But I've always wondered for folks that have the title that have gotten to that place, the most senior level, is there a difference or is it basically seen as the same thing?
I think it's seen as the same thing. I think in tech, the term people officer, people and culture officer is seen more. More traditional, you know, brick and mortar businesses, maybe, or manufacturing things are more chief HR officer, just legacy. So it depends. I think in the federal government, they might still call it personnel.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
We were just talking with someone and they said personnel. I was like,
oh, yeah.
That feels dirty. It felt like human capital management, same thing. Human capital management always bothered me. I just felt like it was a weird way to say it. But Tara, I've got a question. So, tell me if I'm looking at this wrong, and I think I am based on how you described it. A chief people officer, I've always looked at them as managing the people, the culture, right? The engagement of the company, all of that. Whereas HR was more process and ops.
I mean, I think it's like tomato, tomato. To me, in the roles that I play as a chief people officer, I oversee the whole enchilada of it. So it's the HR operations. So we have an HR operations team that's underneath, right? So it's more of an umbrella title, and then it's got all the different nuance underneath it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with what you're saying. You're probably more right than me.
Oh, 100%.
If I'm not right, people will let us know, I'm sure.
Yes.
Have you seen this bit where people get wigged out about the word resources, that humans aren't resources?
Like
I've had this conversation with people that are like, human resources. They're not resources. We're not trees. We're not cotton. We're not this, that, and the other. It's like,
yeah, we cut the far. Not a natural resource. I mean, you can make an argument there. Make your point. I'm sorry.
I found that argument fascinating because I'm like, I'm with both of you. Like, you are a resource and you're going to be deployed as a resource and there's going to be a return on that investment as a resource. So unless you can come up with a better word that's not resource, and you're not caught and you're not tree.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Human capital.
I don't like human capital either.
I don't like human capital. I feel
it
dirty.
Just feels, it does. That's going to be the title. Human capital dirty.
I feel dirty. I want to take a shower. So what's your current gig? What are you doing now?
So my current gig is open to adventure. I have recently just finished my work as a chief people officer for Enthusiast Gaming, which is a really interesting. We were talking a little bit earlier about the gaming industry. Very interesting space to be in, where the intersection of pop culture and all these different sports and esports and all things kind of come together. Mm-hmm. So I was there just until the last couple of weeks, and now I'm on to my next adventure. I've got some consulting work that I'm starting myself. So I'm very excited about the launch of that. But yeah, it's been an interesting journey. My current role and the last few roles have really been about change and helping organizations through some period of change. And I think, you know, change is hard for people. And as a chief people officer, you have to help get people through that kind of change to be a resource and an asset to the company to get that return on investment. So it's an interesting adventure that I've been through. And gaming industry is very, very special right now.
What type of change are we talking about? Digital transformation? Are we dealing with like the change in kind of AI and the intersection of it taking over some of the lower value tasks? Like what type of change projects have you seen?
That, but I'm talking about actual organizational change. So the company that I just came from Enthusiast Gaming, was a conglomeration of multiple acquisitions. So this is culturally, you know, company A buys company B, and now we have to come out of it as company C. And so, you know, getting all of your processes harmonized, getting your people and your culture and people to get to know one another, designing the organization after, you know, changes happened, and then helping people through, you know, through it. So there, I mean, in this regard, my company was publicly traded. So there was this publicly traded piece as well. So I've gone through lots of different change through my history. You know, prior to that, I was at an organization where we were acquired. We not the acquirer, but we were the acquired going through that. Prior to that, I took my company through an IPO. So I've been through lots of different levels of change and trying to get these human resources comfortable in their new environments, or helping them, you know, move along if they're not part of the new future. So,
yeah. So Tara, so today we're talking about you. Surprise. Mm. We're going to learn all about your journey and all that good stuff.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Therapy session is correct. We're going to help you out.
That is correct.
We're going to get you through your troubled times. But before we do, what's keeping you up at night right now? What are you thinking about as you transition from a chief people officer into your own work as a consultant? What's top of mind for you?
I think top of mind for me, what's keeping me up at night is what's keeping the employees up at night. I think employee retention is a huge issue right now. I know that there's a lot of talk about layoffs in certain industries and things of that nature, but the retention piece has been really eating at me quite a bit. It keeps me up for a multitude of reasons. Like for me, there's a lot of choices out there now, and companies have lots of flexibility and other companies don't have much flexibility. How do you keep your employees happy and productive while at the same time balancing, making sure that you are the best place to work so that they want to come and stay here? So it's a huge, that is keeping me up at night.
All right. So I wanted to ask a question about change, but I think it's related to retention. Yeah. It's in a remote world or in a highly flexible world. Yep. How do we solve the algebra of retention? Or how do we solve the algebra of change? Like you just explained, okay, company A, company B, they come together, form company C. Great. When that was bricks and mortar, and fully bricks and mortar, you close down office, you increase office, everyone's in the same spot. Whoop. Okay, I could see that easier from a change perspective, that everyone's in the same box. Because you could communicate, you get in front of people, you have town halls, you can do all this stuff. You're seeing everybody every day, but now as you're thinking about retention, and because you know, said it's top of mind again in a remote environment or even a highly flexible environment. Like my niece works for Deloitte in New York, she doesn't have to go in.
Right.
Occasionally, her boss will say, "Hey, some people are coming by today. Why don't you go in?" But other than that, it's totally up to her whether or not she ever leaves her apartment. And so, like, how do we retain that person? You know, programmatically and otherwise. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's not easy. If I had the answer, I would be like a super billionaire right now. but, you know, I'm working on it. So what I think is in a post, you know, pandemic world, people are exhausted on Zoom. So it's to say, oh, just throw a Zoom meeting and have everybody meet each other and all of that. It's not the same at all. I think what I've found is just having information for people ready to go. Using the internal social media channels, really helpful. And then having the employees form their interest groups. So one of the things that I've seen in the last 2-3 organizations I've been in is these employees are like, hey, listen, I really like cats. I love them. They're awesome. I want to start a group about cats. And so they'll start a group about cats. And then their next thing you know, there's 30 people that are like, yeah, cats are awesome. I'm going to join the cat group. And then that's how they meet each other. So you have to find and create space for people to have their, you know, not just the work, but other right. things. But it's difficult when you push it down from the organization, like we're having a town hall. Right. We're all going to do the town hall, and that's fantastic. And you're going to learn about the company, and there's nothing wrong with that. Town hallers out there, it's good. Information is always a good thing. But you have to have a place for people to have, like, it's basically a break room for people to go to and to speak. And, you know, companies that can afford to get their organizations together in person, you know, if you have your annual meeting or things like that are great. But we've found, you know, post-pandemic, people are sprinkled all over the country, all over the world. And so it's just, yeah, it's not easy. But to me, the more communication and the more platforms for people to organically, you know, find each other right. in non-work seems to be helpful. What are you guys finding? Are you finding this with the people you're talking to?
Yeah, I think the special interest groups and ERGs, they play a wonderful role. We did a podcast. This is with Syneos Health. And it was interesting about this podcast is it was an ERG, the entire ERG that came on the podcast.
Oh, cool.
And we were talking about folks with disabilities, folks that we wanted to actually recruit and retain, and employees within that group of people that wanted to just kind of educate. And it was fascinating because it was a lot of like belonging stuff that kind of came about that too. Not just the, we have things that are in common. You had advocates at the executive level that were basically saying, this is important to us and we don't know much about it. So we're going to bring in some experts and we're going to bring in some employees, but we want to learn more about it so that we can also educate the greater company. And like, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
So I think special interest group ERGs, I love the cafeteria reference. I think that's a really wonderful way of thinking about the water cooler, the cafeteria, or you know, even the after work stuff that used to happen, going to bars, going to baseball games and stuff like that. Any type of bonding and connecting that we can facilitate.
Definitely.
Brian, did you have something to
add? Yeah, I feel like a lot of companies struggle on caring. So you had said
this is the title of the show. That's the title of the show. Company struggle with caring.
Great. I'm so happy to be here.
So, yeah, I was kind of hesitant. So you
let's talk about it. Let's do it.
Well, you said they care about and yes, I remember, and they do Syneos, right? So they do, and I find without. Okay, so I'm struggling with this because I look at it from two different sides. One is we talk to a lot of founders of companies that are mid-size, you know, 500 to 1,000 people plus, right? They've done a really good job. When you talk to those people, they're very, very good at sharing what they care about, their mission. Right. And if you're not careful in the conversation and you just kind of open yourself, you're like, yeah, I'm with you here.
Man,
like,
yeah.
I get this.
Sign me up.
Yeah. But as an employee, you don't always get that feeling because you don't have the connection with the founder. And I'll use myself. Lisa Sterling, we were talking with her, and we both came from Kinexa. And I had that connection with Kinexa where I was like,
right.
Yeah, no, I'm bought in. Like, this is a cult. I'm in. Like, I get it. Like, that's kind of what it felt like. But employees, 100 employees after me, probably didn't have that same experience because they never got to meet the founders. They never got to see the office when it was just folding tables in the manager's offices, right? In leaders' offices. They were literally – when I interviewed, it was literally a folding table with a computer and an Ethernet cable. That was it. Yeah. And I was like, what the hell am I getting into here? But at that point, that's like, it connected. Like, I connected with that. Not everyone gets that. And I knew what they cared about. So I struggle with that because we, you know, a lot of these companies say we care about diversity, or we care about inclusion, or we care about ADA, or we care about this.
Right.
But who cares? Is it the founders of the company down, or is it the HR person or engagement person saying, we're going to go get a list of things that we care about?
I want and Tara's we're answer.
Be the best place to work.
I want Tara's answer, and
but you're gonna
I have an
yours.
Answer. No. I want hers first.
I do struggle with that, and I struggle with believing that. Mm-hmm. But I have been in a couple of companies, one very, yeah. very large, with Enterprise Rent-A-Car, long, this is 2000, like very, very large, but same idea. I fell into that, and I believe the people connect. So everywhere else I've been,
Not so much.
Yeah.
So what do you got, Tara?
I'm just thinking through what you're saying and thinking through kind of where I've worked. And, you know, one of the places that did a really great job that I worked at was Zillow. You know, and the founders were on the board. One of the founders was the CEO. And
their price is very wrong on my house, by the way. Like, they're very below market. Let them know.
I will let my friends at Zillow know.
Yeah.
So they did really, really well. Is every single month they had a session with the CEO, and he would sit down and just do a Q&A with anyone that was brand new. And then every month we would have, you know, a town hall meeting, and we would learn, what is the play? What are we doing this month? What are we trying to accomplish this month? He would give out his phone number at the beginning of every session. We were 1,000 employees. He's like, here's my phone number. If you have a question for me, and he would answer every text and every phone call and every email that came through. And so even though that had scaled, I think he was probably, his name was Spencer Raskoff. Hi, Spencer. Shout out to you. He did a fantastic job, and everybody knew what was going on. Everybody cared. It made the HR job very easy because we had that support. I've worked at other companies where we've had founder-led, you know, CEOs, and I think you're right. I think when you're in the top echelon of the organization, you're hearing this person day in and day out in your echelons, because you really need that trickle down through the layers of leadership. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we did recently at Enthusiast Gaming, and then prior to, I had the same CEO at both organizations, is we started a senior leadership team, and they would come together every month. And so we would start to have them engaged in the culture, in the, what do we stand for? What is our mission? What is our vision? And then we started to embrace that, put our core values together, and really use them towards, you know, when we had one-on-ones with employees and performance management conversations, it's, are you doing this value? What are we doing? Why are we here? And that's been very helpful for me. But if you don't have that, and you don't have that support and that trickle down, I think you're right, Ryan. It's just words.
Yeah.
Right. So Ryan, I'll draw you a little picture, because I know you're a visual learner. Caring. Three-legged stool.
Are we going dark?
No. I would never do that to you.
No.
Three-legged stool. Okay, three-legged stool, just envisioned, mm-hmm. right? Communication.
Can I spread the legs out so I can sit evenly?
100%.
All right.
So communication, access, and budget. That's how you create caring. That's how you validate. If someone says they care, you can ask three probative questions. Okay, you say you care about diversity. Great. What's the budget that you put behind it? What's the communication strategy that you put behind it? And what's the access to the executives and the board that we have that can validate it? That's it. I mean, it really is that simple of algebra. If you're trying to solve for, again, visual learner, I'm doing John Nash and Beautiful Mind at this point. But the whole idea is, if you're solving the algebra for caring, You just ask those three probative questions, and you'll either get that they care, or you'll find that no, those are just words.
Really interesting.
Fair? Tara, nice. Thanks for joining us today.
Stop it. All right. We got to go back, because Laura and I love going back to high school and college. What'd you want to be? What'd you want to be when you grew up?
And I'm very glad I did.
If you say chief people officer, I'm going to come through the screen.
Yes.
No, okay. You will not come through the screen. So my
she wanted to be CHRO, but they pushed her over to the people.
I'm telling you, no. I wanted to be a journalist, actually. I wanted to be a political journalist. I wanted to be in the White House press corps, and thank God I didn't do that. That's pretty horrible now.
Yeah.
Those people get treated like shit.
In the West Wing, in the TV show The West Wing, oh my. Yes, it's. I just watched. We watched House of Cards, and that was dark. But the press corps got treated a certain way, and in The West Wing, the TV show The West Wing, the press corps got treated a certain way. But there was a little bit more respect in that TV show as opposed to House of Cards. But I don't. I think you're both right. I think right now that's not a job that I would really wish to have.
No.
At all.
No. So
did you go to school for journalism?
I did. I started out as a journalism major. I went to Cal State Fullerton. I have to tell you the story of how I didn't become a journalist. I sat in a class and the professor was adjunct and he was a reporter for the Orange County Register, which is a local paper here.
Yeah, and of course.
He sits down, he goes, I'm professor. And I don't remember his name anymore because he was that memorable. And this is going to be the semester where you learn about journalism. You're going to make $25,000 a year. You're not going to work. You're going to work nights, weekends, holidays. You'll never see your family. And you'll be writing about shit you don't care about. Welcome to the class. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I hate this.
You need to find that guy's name. I want to interview him.
Well, you know amazing. What? He was right. He was right.
He was doing service, right?
He was doing everybody a disservice. I mean, he was doing everybody a service. Because he's telling the truth. Whereas if you talk to other people in journalism that have, you know, gotten a Pulitzer and whatnot, they won't tell you that stuff.
That's true.
Right? So he was actually coming in with the truth, and the truth got you redirected, I would assume, to comms?
Yep. So I ended up being a public relations major. During college, I worked at Disney.
By the way, Ryan, that's where all failed journalists go.
You know,
I just guessed that, by the way. That's how how that works. I had no previous knowledge.
Could you be a failed journalist if you weren't a journalist at all to begin with, though?
That's correct.
I was a PR major. I worked at Disney during college because I went to Cal State Fullerton, which is also known as Cal State Disneyland for the locals.
Oh, yeah.
I was a Disney tour guide, so that got the PR thing kind of moving.
No, they don't call employees. You are a
cast member.
You are a cast member. How was that? How did that impact your view of HR?
Well, it was interesting, right? Because I was a tour guide. And when you're a tour guide, you're also the guest relations, which basically is similar to employee relations because you have people that are coming in and they've got certain things they need to tell you. And some things are 100%. Great and they want to tell you what's great. But most of the time, there's something else. And of course, as cast members, we're performing a role. And so we have to act like we loved everything that we were hearing. We should have a whole other podcast with the secrets of Disney.
I'm in.
100%.
Yeah. So, but it was great. I mean, it was helpful as I was a PR major because it gave me some of that. And I ended up interning in two places. One was the Richard Nixon Library and Birthplace. I got my presidential fix.
I've been there. Recently, the last couple of years. It's fantastic.
PR internship there. And then I did an internal comms internship at a company that called Miracal, and I was working with the HR department. So that's where the first kind of HR came into play just a little bit. So that's where I started to see the dark side just a tiny bit.
I was about to say, did you fall in love with HR?
I didn't. Or... No. Not then. No, I didn't.
I feel like we're getting to a point of I needed a job.
I so love this. So what was after that?
I ended up, for the first 3 years of my career, I ended up doing true public relations and marketing. So I was working with a boutique marketing firm, and we were doing grand openings for Panda Express and Wiener Schnitzel and Marie Callender's and all sorts of restaurant clients. It was super fun. And then, you know, the fun and joy kind of ended during there was a recessionary period after 9/11, and nobody cared that the Panda Express was opening its 400th restaurant anymore because things weren't really that wasn't really
fair enough.
Budget
fair enough.
So I went to my local recruiting firm and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a job," and they're like, "How about being a recruiter? You can come work for us." And that's how I came in. So I felt I truly did fall into HR and having a little bit of background. That's how it started for me. So that's my career journey started from there. And
then, what are you on? It was this a staffing firm?
It was a staffing firm, and I was doing, you know, the full cycle desk where you had to go out and do your business development, go find your people, mm-hmm. and then you had to go fill it. So find it.
The most inefficient process in the world, but it works.
It's a hustle. Hustle game. Mm-hmm. We had Amy Miller on yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah.
And we were just talking. I'm like, because I think Ryan and I have a theory that staffing people that have a staffing background as recruiters make better corporate recruiters. And Amy corrected us and said, "Well, maybe, maybe not, but it's the hustle game. Can they actually hustle and get the job done?"
But they're weak on the politics.
They're weaker on the politics. Yeah.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, she said, so as a staffing, she was a big biller, all that type of stuff. And she said, what I had to learn my first couple of years on the corporate side is the political game that gets played internal.
Oh, that's true. Right. You don't get the inside there.
You don't get that bit. You just got place. You got, hiring manager. You need a body. Great. Okay. Done. And she was really great at that. And it's always kind of modified my thinking about staffing that they can make better corporate recruiters, but they're going to have to learn the politics pretty fast.
Yep. Well, that was my next step after that. So you're like walking me through my, this is very therapeutic, by the way.
It's cathartic. We're not done yet.
Man. So yeah. So after that, right. So I was working at this staffing agency and my old internship, Maricao, which I told you about from the beginning where I was like, hey, not interested, calls me, the director of HR, and says, I see you're doing recruiting now. How about you come over and start recruiting for us, bringing our stuff in house? And so thought about it, thought about the hustle. And I was like,
I think I could have a standard mm-hmm. salary every two weeks. I think, yeah. Health benefits. You bet. Sure.
So I joined over there and this is the beginning of all the change management. They had just done an acquisition. And so they brought me in, they were moving their recruiting. Recruiting was on stone and tablet and chisel.
100%. They needed to 100%. Automate. Note cards. Mimeographic paper.
This is the old days, right? Yeah, old days.
She was still processing on WordPerfect.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Dot matrix printer, the whole bit.
There was one of those in their accounting department. All the little, like the paper with the, and it was like green and white paper, right?
Yeah, with the dot. Yeah. The little,
oh, my God, I'm aging myself.
No, we're good. You're in a safe area.
Thank you.
I wasn't born until after fax machines ended.
No one's listening to that. So you brought all, did all the recruiters come under you?
They didn't have any recruiters there. So they were using staffing firms only. So that was a cost savings thing. They were bringing it
all
in-house. However, things went a little sideways when I got there because somebody didn't do, this is like a dirty word, but it's due diligence. They didn't do their due diligence with the merger and the acquisition. So there were some issues that arose from that, such as they didn't realize that they had people with I-9s that weren't.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So all of a sudden, I had 37 open requisitions.
Oh, wow.
That needed to be filled. And
the department of corporate recruiting.
Homeland Security knocking on my door, doing an investigation. So I learned how to be an HR generalist real quick and needed to get a fast education. I mean, I have to say, when you don't know what to do, and being new in HR, I didn't know where to go. And so this director of HR, I think she might have been a VP by that time. She's like, you've got to learn. You've got to do everything you can. Join. There's this organization. It's called SHRM. Go join it. There's local groups. Go join it. Go just learn. Go take classes.
Ira.
Whatever. Yep. And that was the big like change for me. So
you were active in Pyra, weren't you?
I am the current president of Pyra. Yes,
that's what I thought. Yeah. I went out and spoke at it a couple of times. I loved it. It's a huge. I mean, it's a very large group. People don't understand how big that group is. That's a really good, great, cool. Congratulations on being president. By the way, not easy. Not easy. Because no. It's Ryan, when you run, first of all, it's a nonprofit, right? So there's that. But it's the herding of volunteers of towards an end goal, because you have an annual conference, but you've also got things that are going on through the year.
Yeah.
And the herding towards that annual conference is, it's a heavy lift. I mean, I think y'all had the Anaheim Conference Center when I went to it.
That's where we're getting ready again. It's going to be May 20th to the 22nd, and we're in the same.
That's not a small venue. That is a large venue, by the way. That is a large venue.
How many people are coming to this event?
Usually we get between 1,000 and 2,000 people, just depending. Nice. With pandemic, we've been doing it hybrid, so people can join virtually too. So in person, roughly 1,000, I think. Maybe more. I'm sure our executive director and our CEO is looking at me going, Tara, I'm sure it's like 2,500.
100%.
Tara, we had 400 people last year.
Well, the thing is getting people back to conferences, that's not easy.
It's hard.
I mean, after COVID, most people are like, travel? Why would I travel? Yeah, I get my continuing education credits on webinars or whatever else. Like, why go? Yeah. But it's that networking that happens at those events inside the sessions, but also outside the sessions, that it's like, you can meet your next employer.
That happened to me.
Yep.
So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I actually ended up working at SHRM. I was an employee of SHRM, and that was through attending the government affairs, the legislative advocacy conference here in California. And I met a few folks like Mike Aitken and some of the other. People out at, and Pam Green back in the day.
Oh, I love Pam Green. Gosh, she's greatness.
She's amazing.
What did you do for SHRM?
So for SHRM, I worked out of Alexandria, Virginia, and I was on the membership team. So my role was student membership and the young professional network. So it was really getting those people that were up and coming in HR that actually knew they wanted to do HR in college, unlike myself, who thought journalism was the key. These folks were smart and already knew that's probably HR is the one. So that was my role. And actually we had you speaking at our conference. We had one in Austin. God, it was probably 10 plus years ago.
Yep. That was such a fun bit. Ryan, you had a question? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to continue the career, but now that we're talking about you talking to young students about career advice, the door has been open. I wasn't going to mention this.
Uh-oh.
But I'm sure you did a wonderful job. But I need to know, what did you tell them about what they're getting ready to embark on in their illustrious careers?
I think I told them why I fell in love with HR, and also told them that, you know, the job of understanding people and people's desires and engaging with people, it's a relentless pursuit. Like, it's not you get there and it's done, you know, because by the time you get there and you've engaged that person, they're on to something else. Mm-hmm. They're interested in something else. And so I think it was more about getting them to understand the complexities of both engaging and retaining talent. And again, caring. I mean, getting back to something you brought up very early on, it's you can have the knowledge of HR, but can you carry it forth and show people that you care about them and their needs? And I think I even at that point, I was probably more of a employee advocate, candidate advocate type of person, where it was more about, hey, listen, you're going to get pushed in between two forces of the company's needs and the employee's needs. And at one point, you're going to have to pick, because you can't be both. And the company is paying you, so you want to hold that. You want to be loyal to that. But really, your loyalty needs to be to employees and candidates.
Right.
And so you've got to – that's a very fine line, very hard line to toe, by the way. But, yeah. I didn't show them any of the darkness. I didn't want to scare them.
Signs up and be like, you're
dead. I didn't want to scare them out of it. I just want them to understand that it's a noble profession. And it's really a noble pursuit to actually care about employees. But, you know, again, it's not easy also.
Yeah. So, Tara, William brought up a point just now. At one point in time, you're going to have to choose. Are you an advocate for the company or are you an advocate for the people? I know perfect world, you're down the center and you right. represent both, which of course we're always going to in the space. How does someone in that role who's struggling with that, how do they pick a side? Where do they go?
Yeah. I'm going to say the first thing is it always depends, right? That's the lame answer. But it does depend on what it is.
It and I does. Think
you have to weigh the facts, right? To me, you have to look at the whole thing and you have to be able to look at it from every angle and mm-hmm. then
right.
understand which is going to bring the greatest return for that, you know, that decision. If I go in this direction with the company, am I doing my fiduciary duty to make sure that right. I'm keeping the company, you know, de-risked from whatever that decision would be? And then if I don't make that decision, what is the risk to the company? And then you look at the employee and what is the risk to them as well? I think depending on what the situation is, you could fall either which way. And I hate to say right. that. I don't mean to be the you know, on the fence
no,
person, but it really does. You know,
it's looking at things that are legal, moral, and ethical. If either takes you outside yeah. of the bounds, it's easy to side with the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So if a company takes you outside of legal bounds, then you That's obviously right. are going to protect the employees. Right. If an employee takes you outside of legal bounds, you're obviously going to protect the employer. So it is going to be situational, for sure. But you've got to care. So many people in HR come out and are kind of mass produced to just care about the company. And it's like, mm-hmm. you know, that's that old fashioned, hey, Sally, can you bring a box to HR, gather all your things type stuff. And like HR, people don't want to approach HR.
Right.
Because they don't see them as advocates. And I think that's a very old way of thinking of HR. Modern yeah. way of thinking mm-hmm. of HR is like, these people care about me. Yeah. So I may as well tell them the truth. And again, depending on where the ethics and morality and legality fall, then you have to, as an HR professional, you have to protect whomever.
And that's therein lies my feelings earlier about, does the company really truly care? Because my contact is with you, Tara, right, as HR.
Mm-hmm.
Do you care for me? Do you care for the company? And if I don't feel that you care for me, the company doesn't care about anything it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
In my mind, that's kind of how I always have taken it.
I think you're right. In many ways, we're the ambassador, right? So if you have if you're a great HR and people person, you're going to do mm-hmm. well. Your employees will feel that you care. But if you are, to William's point, the transactional HR operational kind of person, then that will come through as well, which is why I think like the HR business partner role has been such a great, you know, addition to the HR, you know, suite of capabilities that we do, because that really is that partnership and that feeling of that. I will say, you know, for most recently, we had to go through, you know, a layoff right before I was departed. Mm-hmm. I was impacted by that as well. Right. So I had to have the task of letting people know that their roles were not going to be there any longer. And we sat for a while to think about, you know, what is the best way to do this? Because we do care about the individuals and we care about how they feel and we want to be fair with them, but at the same time, understanding that the organization was going through what they were going through and there was a need, you know, to preserve, you know, financials and all that, those kind of things. So it's like that balance of what do you do? And the employees are coming back saying, is this all I get for severance? I mean, can I get more? And so you've got to figure out that balance point between keeping the company safe, right? You want to make sure that you're not spending all the money that the company is, you know, not budgeting mm-hmm. for, but you also want to make sure that this person feels like in that time of need that you're there to help them all the way through from when they were, you know, very first offered a position until when, you know, that time is that you say goodbye. And I guess this is maybe a weird thing, but like you look at, you know, how many people came back afterwards with a complaint or a letter or a grievance. And I think, you know, my team and I thought really hard about that. How do we do that? And we set up actually Calendly's with them. Hey, if you need to talk to us at any time, set it up on your schedule when you feel like you want to talk to us. And then let's hear what you have to say. And then giving them the empower and let them feel like they were under control was a way that we would show caring, rather than saying, come to a meeting. Like you said, come to a meeting at 2:00 and we're going to talk about this. You know, that way that you at least you make people feel like they're important and that they get to decide. but at the same time, you still have the controls of the company, and you're still, you know, holding that, you know, to account. So I don't know if that's a great example, but it's just top of mind for me. It's just, you know, when we have to say goodbye to people, it's just as important as when they're here.
Right. Well, you did all this stuff in the romance phase to recruit them. You could at least be humane in what you do next with it.
Right.
And so I think companies that over-index on doing a great job in the candidate experience should do as equal of a good job in the alumni experience.
I like so the alumni experience. That's great.
So whether or not you choose to, or it's been chosen for you to, you're now an alumnus. And we should care about you in the same sense that we care about when we brought you in. So, you know, I think that, again, care, using that word loosely, Ryan. I just have one question left, Tara. One, it's just the advice now knowing what you know about your own career and kind of also what you've seen with everybody else, because being president of do y'all say PHRA or do y'all? Because I've always said Pyra. Okay, good. Thank you.
You're right.
So being president of Pyra, you also get to see a lot of other peers. The advice that you would give kind of a younger version of yourself, what would it be?
To do the hard thing first, right? It's muddle through it. For me, going and getting master's degree, doing all the things that are hard first, and then not to be afraid to use your voice is the other one. I think as a younger professional, you might see things and you're like, ooh, I don't know if I should do it. You know, I don't know. And you get tentative about it. But I've learned as I've gone, you know, longer in my career and gotten bolder, I guess, and maybe that's something that happens with age and experience. But to speak up, if you see something that you don't agree with, if you're in a executive meeting or you're in a team meeting and people are going a certain direction and you feel like maybe you have a better suggestion, a lot of times people will just sit quietly because they don't want that attention on them. But don't be afraid to do that because you're valuable.
Not to be controversial, but is that young in one's career, they just don't have the confidence, or is it?
I didn't have the confidence.
Well, I'm not. God, Tara, I wasn't pointing you out. The is
saying, didn't.
I wonder how much of this is gender related, and why I'm asking that is, I'm not sure I've ever shut up. So I struggle with this part. This could be a personality flaw. Character flaw. Mm. Like if I've been in a boardroom and someone says something stupid, even in my 20s, I would say, yeah, that's fucked up. That's stupid.
It could be.
Like I would just say that. Now, I don't think I had the articulation now that I do now in terms of being able to back that up, but I could point it out. And I did point it out. But, do you see anything? I mean, I don't want to make something that's not there, not be there. Do you see anything that's gender there? Or is it just you're early in your career and you're just, one is not as confident as they are elder in their career?
You know, that's an interesting point, and that's my therapy to take back and really think about for myself. But in general, I do think women in general do have struggles with speaking up. I think it's one of those things where, getting to that level, when you get to the executive level, you don't have very many people that look like you sitting around the table. And so maybe there might be a little bit of that going on. I think for me, it wasn't so much that as it was just me not being a confident. I didn't have the experience under my belt. So I felt like I was struggling with people, you know, thinking that I was too young to have an opinion.
Mm. So, see, good allies, this is the thing now that we know more than we did years ago, is now good allies, when that person's quiet, you call on them and say, Tara, what do you think? Obviously, you've heard kind of all the point, counterpoint stuff. You got a strong opinion either way? Like the allies have to pull that stuff out. They got to tease that stuff out and say, hey, you know, what do you think? Because if we don't do that, then yeah, I think we could exacerbate the problem.
It's interesting you say that. I know we're coming up on on time, but I can remember fresh out of college, early 20s, I had a lot of opinions personally, right? And I never had an issue at all telling my managers, my bosses, people, my opinion was my opinion, and I was that guy. But when I started to get, and this was very quickly, I would start to get invited into what at the time seemed like higher level sales meetings and strategy meetings because of my opinion. I was a mouse at the table.
Really?
And I didn't say any. Part of it was because I didn't, now, gender aside, I didn't look as distinguished as the people in my view of it. I'm looking around the table, salt and pepper hair, right? They've been there. They've got the, you know, the look. I'm just like, yeah, what's up? Like I was the young kid on the block and I didn't talk like them. And so I shut up and I remember that. But William, you made a point, an ally asked you.
That's right.
And so the people that brought me into the room, I'm sure everybody else around the table is like, what the hell is he doing here? The person that brought me in said, Ryan, I'm interested to get your take on this. Immediately, I had the confidence, well, after a first time or two, I had the confidence to talk like me. I didn't have to talk like them.
Right.
And they took the advice and they took my thoughts for what it was. I was still wearing hoodies, like same deal. It's just who I was. And it was at that moment, because there's a lot of things that I wanted to say, and I'm sure you, Terry, you probably come across this. You don't say it, and somebody else says it, and they're like, that is amazing. I'm like, you motherfucker. Like, I literally should have just said that, right? But when someone started to pull it out of me, that's when I changed. That's when I changed. I said, you know, I don't need to look like you. I don't need to feel like you. I don't even need to back it up. I'm just going to say it. And that was my fear. I couldn't back it up. But, you know, different than gender. But that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
No, that makes perfect sense. I think once you have the confidence, though, that is it. And to me,
very different.
You need that validation maybe a little bit, like the first couple of times. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to hear your opinion and those kind of things. And now.
And after that, you're on your own. You're good.
Well, right. And now I think, you know, when you're in this position and you're a leader in HR, you are the ambassador for the employees and the voice. And when you see something that's right or wrong, you can't be shy to say anything, because that's when you're not doing your duty to your company and to the people that you support. Yeah. So
you're also in a great position now where if you see those people being quiet in that meeting, you're like, okay, I know what's going on here.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Tara, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. Love what you're doing. Love that you're tackling change, because it's not easy. And thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's been